Welcome back to the Equiloquy podcast. I'm super stoked to be recording today as I'm welcoming my first guest onto the podcast. Today's episode should be quite interesting. It is on a topic that both of us are quite passionate about. And what drove this passion for me in particular is that when I was 15, I made my lease horse's mouth bleed during a lesson in front of his owners. I was using a training aid that was marketed to lower and collect his head. And it left me mortified and I felt horrible and they went right in the trash. I could not subject another horse to this. And since then, I have not gone anything near anything similar. And now I advocate for training horses naturally with as minimal intervention as possible. Nothing good comes easy. Most of us have heard this term at some point in our lives, but what does it mean in its application to training horses? I'm excited to welcome Elisa Wallfish to the podcast. Elisa is an equine body worker and biologist with an extensive background in research. She started riding horses when she was around 8 years old in the hunter jumper circuit, where she went on to compete at the provincial level. She recently started training dressage and is currently producing her four-year-old mare in a more groundwork-centered manner. When the backing process with her mare went horribly wrong, it forced her to reconsider how she communicated with horses, and it made her realize the importance of considering physical over behavioral. She got her bodywork certification to be able to better assess the pain and discomfort that her mare was going through. It was then that she realized that there are surely more welfare-centric ways to go about building a relationship with a horse, and it brought her down the road of advocacy in the way that Elisa knows best, with science. Elisa is here with me today to put that knowledge and science to work and provide insight on some popular training gadgets that claim to work a horse's body in a certain way or prevent their body from performing certain movements. We will discuss a variety of common training gadgets used on the lunge and under saddle, what they claim to do, if the biomechanics back up these claims, and how they could have negative effects on your horse's health. For horses who still need support, we will also discuss some healthier alternatives. So welcome, Elisa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So when most people hear bodywork, or at least when I heard the term of equine bodywork, I thought more about massage, chiropractic, acupuncture, kind of the treatment plans that these horses go through when they need support. But obviously there's more to it. So what is bodywork to you?
Well, you're absolutely right. Body work is actually more of an umbrella term that encompasses different type of therapeutic techniques and methodologies. But primarily the purpose of equine body work is to enhance performance and mobility. So body work will help improve a horse's range of motion, flexibility, and ultimately the overall performance. You know, we could address muscular tightness, joint stiffness, and other types of physical restrictions that are brought on by sports. You could also really have a plan to prevent injuries. So regular body work will help identify and address minor issues before they become a major problem. So for injury prevention, it is part of an essential routine for a sport horse. It can also promote recovery, so reduce inflammation, alleviate pain, a little bit of enhanced circulation. And ultimately, like any massage treatment, could also help reduce stress and anxiety. So body work for some horses that are more used to it, it could have a really huge calming effect on the horse, help reduce, as I said, stress and anxiety. And it could really be beneficial for high-strung and nervous horses that might be a little bit more prone to reactivity. So body work is just essentially a way to improve the overall health and well-being of your horse. And, you know, there's a lot of different techniques. Massage therapy can include myofascial release, acupressure, chiropractic adjustments, stretching exercises, you know, just to help with musculoskeletal system, creating balance, and promote efficient movement patterns.
Very cool. Awesome. Definitely a skill to have. Yeah, when I was a groom, the horses regularly got body work. I think they mainly got massage and chiropractor, and a few of them got acupuncture as well. But you could see on the horses' faces that they were kind of releasing all of that tension and stress, and it really felt quite good to them. And horses know how to move their bodies, we know that, but I think if there's tension in certain areas, they don't quite have the knowledge to know, oh, I can stretch my leg in a certain way and it'll release this tension. So it was nice to see these horses get help in a way that athletes deserve. So that was really great to see. But one of the things that I did notice was that there was one horse in particular, and she had quite extensive scarring along her back from being ridden in a saddle that didn't fit properly. So not only could the body worker feel the scarring under her tissue, but she had quite a lot of white hairs on her back, so it was visible damage as well. And in my opinion, even with Band-Aids, wounds can't heal if they continued to be open up. How effective do you think body work can be if the horse is being exercised, continuously exercised in a damaging or restrictive way?
It can't. The short answer is it really can't. I mean, when you approach a horse that has a particular problem, you could do all you can to release the tension and aid circulation. But if it's a reoccurring practice that causes this strain, it'll just come back continuously. And I'm really adamant in educating my clients that it's really important to find the root cause. And sometimes, you know, they don't necessarily realize what they're doing to the horse, and you don't have a global understanding exactly of the routine of this horse because you're not in this horse's life constantly. And so, I mean, you could identify points that are damaged or that are strained. But unless you go to the root cause of it, and usually that's what it is, you know, ill-fitted tack. Usually I see a lot of really bad feet that could really cause compensatory problems. And so unless you fix those root causes, the problem is always going to come back continuously. So even if you have me over every 4 weeks to treat a sore back, if you're not changing your saddle, nothing is going to change. And, you know, it's very discouraging I think I speak for all body workers when you continuously see a horse with the same problems and nothing has changed, then obviously that you can't really do much for that.
Yeah, I have seen that a lot personally. But I've never seen the behind the scenes conversations between body workers and clients. Is it in your kind of experience with the horse and with the rider afterwards, if you have a suspicion or if you see the horse being ridden in a way that you think isn't conducive to good health, do you feel an obligation to mention that to the rider? Or are there some body workers out there who you think just take the clients as they come, take the horses as they come, adjust them, massage them, whatever, send them on their way? How much is investigating the root cause widespread across body workers, and do you do it yourself?
I don't think in this case I could speak for any other body worker. For me personally, it's kind of a touchy space because of the fact that you don't want to bring shame or guilt to the owner in any way. I mean, usually people, they get to this point because they don't know what they don't know, right? And your responsibility as a professional is obviously to educate your clients. Where it gets a little gray zoned is that we aren't vets, so we cannot diagnose and we cannot prescribe a specific rehab protocol. And so all I could do as a body worker is identify points that are a little bit more that are under tension and try to discuss with the client where it could come from. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to kind of steer them into figuring it out by themselves of what's doing this and what's causing the pain. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I don't have the authority, I guess, to really pose a strict opinion on what the owner should change as a routine. I could only bring in kind of like soft recommendations or hint the client towards the answer. There are, and I mean, since we're talking about restrictive equipment today, there is a lot of instances where I have seen damage in the body due to restrictive equipment, such as lunging aids. And that's a really touchy subject as well, because usually it comes from the trainer and you don't want to get between the client and his trainer. And usually the client is kind of dependent on what, you know, the trainer is recommending for them. And so you kind of have to position yourself more as part of the team than on the outside of the team and try to work together to find a better plan that will accommodate the horse better in what you're feeling in the body.
Yeah, I definitely see how that could be a hard situation, especially because I think riders who use restrictive training aids like lunging systems, they're not marketed as, oh, this is going to restrict your horse, this is going to prevent your horse from bending in this way. They're marketed towards helping your horse function and helping them move in a certain way. So if you have a client who's using, for example, say a PSOA system, and maybe it's a little more tight than it should be, and it's causing damage to the horse's body, they're probably not going to take someone coming up and saying, hey, you're hurting your horse, very well, because that's not their intention whatsoever. And that's something that throughout this journey of improving equine welfare, I've really run into, is these people aren't intentionally causing damage to their horse. They're trying to help them. And so when someone comes up to them and says, hey, you're actually hurting your horse, they're like, no, I'm not. I'm doing quite the opposite. So I completely understand how navigating that situation could be quite a touchy subject and difficult, especially when you don't have the authority to diagnose. It could definitely be a difficult situation for sure. But let's talk about some of these restrictive gadgets that we keep mentioning. I'd like to personally start off with draw reins, because that is something that I've seen quite often. And what I thought was interesting is I went to one of these websites that sells them, and draw reins were marketed as a training aid that influences raising the head of the horse's neck, and it says specifically that they must never be straightened like classic reins, and that good draw rein use allows the horse's head and neck to remain open and are not to help the horse on the bit. However, every single time that I have seen someone use draw reins, they have been tight like classic reins. And this is a topic and a gadget that I want to talk about because they are so popular and they do seem to work so well for riders who have a certain outcome. And I've always looked at them as restrictive and people don't see it that way. So if you would like to talk about draw reins from a biomechanical bodywork perspective, I would love to hear the insight on that.
Sure. So draw reins attach to the bit and then go under the girth, as you said. So for sure, if you have a tight draw rein that kind of fixes the horse's head in place, then you're kind of defying the purpose of teaching a horse to release into that position. But even then, we could talk about draw reins exclusively, but I think that they're kind of the same concept as every other single training aid that you have out there, where it kind of goes against the basics of horse training. And I'm in no way like a professional horse trainer. I just have a general understanding of what operant conditioning is. And I know that any type of lunging aid does not help the horse understand what it is that you want. And so ultimately with any lunging aid, you want the horse to understand to use his core and engage his hind end and ultimately lower his head. But these types of aids, they don't facilitate understanding in the activations of these muscles. And so all you're doing is causing brace against the bit. And so withdraw reins, so you're pulling the bit down and towards the girth. So not only are you forcing the head down, but you're forcing the horse to go behind the vertical. And that comes with a lot of different problems, which I guess we'll get to during this podcast. So basically, I mean, I guess that if you use them as intended and leave them a little bit more loose, I don't see, and, you know, that's what frustrates me a lot about people that use these types of aids, is that usually, you know, they go a bit on the defensive and say, yeah, but I leave it loose anyways, so it doesn't really affect the horse's biomechanics. But if you're having it loose, then why have them at all, right? And so usually when the people really want a quick fix and an effective or drastic change by using these aids, they're going to use them more severely, so tighter, shorter. And so that's where you really get a brace against the bit.
Yeah, thank you. And in my experience personally in the hunter jumper world, I have never had someone tell me that they are using draw reins to raise the height of the horse's neck. I have heard them being used to make riding easier for more control. I have never had someone explain the use of them from a biomechanical perspective. All they seem to want is actually, unfortunately, to restrict the horse, because actually I saw a video of someone saying that when their horse was fresh and in threatening to rear, they would use draw reins because it gave a person a fixed amount of control, because when you pull back, you're sliding the rein through the bit, and then that's connected to the girth, so it almost creates a triangle of movement, and they can't go outside of that movement or they will feel more. And it really is just a simple concept of pressure and release. And the horse does not understand what you want them to do. It's correct. It's not, all they see is, oh, when I lift my head out, I don't feel as much pressure. When I lift my head in, I feel a lot more pressure, or vice versa. Horses are prey animals. They want to be comfortable. They will do whatever it takes to survive. And if that means giving to pressure, they will do it. That's all it is to them. They don't understand what you want them to do. And so when you remove the draw reins, the horse kind of just falls apart, or they have been ridden in such a fixed position. That's all they really know how to put their head. That's all they know where to put their head, because they are so used to, oh, if I put my head out further, I feel pressure. So I won't put my head out further, even if I don't have draw reins on. And so I never really understood the purpose behind draw reins, simply because everyone that has used them has used them for control, which has been very unfortunate for me to see.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think the illusion of control really comes from the fact that the horse stuck in that position has no balance, a shortened stride, no range of motion, and is not able to use his body properly. And so you have kind of a sense of, you know, a lot of people talk about having a ball of energy under them with a horse that's really like using himself properly and under himself. But here you really just have an unhealthy contraction of the body where he's not able to extend his stride and use his head for balance. And so you just have a very constricted horse. You don't have control, really.
Yeah. And someone that I follow on Instagram, I'm sure you've heard of her, Shelby Dennis, she made a really good point, is that training horses with restriction or using a lot of aversives, it's kind of like a rubber band. You can stretch it and you can stretch it and it might work for a certain amount of time, and then all of a sudden it snaps. And that's when you get that explosion with horses, where they've been so restricted for so long and they've been so tolerant of it for so long, and then all of a sudden it's just, I can't take this anymore. And that's when you get the rearing, the bucking, the fits. That's when you get the spooking. And I think that there's some sort of normalization of that, and that that just means that the horse has gotten used to the training aid, or they just don't respect it anymore, and now we have to move on to something stronger. Or that that's just the way that the horse is, right? This horse is just an explosive horse that needs to be restricted like this. And that's mainly where I see draw reins being used, is I'm going to take this ball of energy and kind of just put it into my hands. Instead of the horse being the ball of energy alone, I'm controlling it. You're still a ball of energy, but I can restrict you however much I want. And that's my main issue with that, is just, first of all, restriction, and second of all, not giving horses autonomy, because they cannot speak our languages, they cannot verbally explain to us, this hurts, this feels sore, this hurts my neck, etc. And so restricting horses, in my opinion, can never be good for them for any amount of time. Because all behavior in them is communication. And if we suppress behavior, it doesn't go away. It just bundles up until it has to be released.
Absolutely right.
So that's kind of draw reins, and then kind of just an overall overview of kind of the other ridden restrictive sorts of aids. Something else that I wanted to talk about was fixed martingales. Like in the English, we have standing martingales in the hunter circuit. And then in Western, what's really common is a tie down. So it's, I'm 99% sure that it's always fixed. I don't think that they have, or at least they're not popular ones that are on bungees, but in the Western world, it's basically just a nose, for those that are listening that don't know, it's just a nose band and then a piece of leather that connects to either a breastplate or under the girth, and then a standing martingale. There's already the nose band on the hunter bridles. It's just a piece of leather that straps under the chin or under the nose, and then it connects around the neck and underneath to the girth. And essentially what it does, my understanding of what it does, is it literally just prevents the horse from lifting their head up too high. And my understanding of where it originates from, at least in the hunter circuit, is that I think you get docked points if your horse is out of a certain frame or is, you know, lifting their head up too high. In my experience, I have never seen someone jump in the hunter circuit without a standing martingale. And it just seems like such a jolt of force when they do go out of it, that it's so normalized, and I don't think many people think of it, but I can't see a reason why something fixed and leather, so not something very easily breakable, would be so common in horses. So if you would like to talk about these fixed martingales, kind of what they do in a more deeper sense, and then what it does to the horse when they do go out of that range of motion.
Sure. So for me, the tie down and the fixed, or the standing martingale, I personally think that it's more of a behavioral issue. I think that people use them because the horse is trying to express something. And as I guess we know, when a horse is lifting his head that high that you need to tie it down, there's something else going on, right? So they're trying to evade pressure, they're trying to evade pain, usually from the back. It could be also stress behavior, and so I think that the tie down or the standing martingale for me is also has physical implications for sure, but I think that where it originates the most is riders that so we see them a lot in the hunter ring, but I think as well in for school horses, where trainers kind of put the tie down just to avoid the school horses, you know, putting their heads up and helping the kids have more control. The biggest issue with these aids is the pull pressure that it exerts when a horse slams into it. And so you could really, really see the damage in the pull area. And also if a horse is trying to brace against that pressure, you'll see an overdevelopment of the underneck as well. And so I think it's really important when you judge important to have some sort of tie down on your horse to really get through the underlying cause of why you need it. If the horse is throwing his head up like that, I think that there's major issues. It's not just an issue where the horse is out of balance and you want to strengthen the horse. No, this is really, in my opinion, a behavioral problem stemming from underlying physical issues. And so for this particular one, I think it really warrants more investigation. And this is really like the prime example of a quick, easy fix, because, you know, you just kind of want to mask the behavior. And but for the hunter ring, I think that, and this is really just personal opinion, I think that it's become more of a trend or just kind of part of the equipment that's usually used in hunters.
Almost as if you didn't use one, you would be seen as, you know, it would be more of a judging thing. Like, why don't you have one on your horse?
Yeah,
everyone else is using one.
Exactly. I think it's just more of a habit that people have of putting these on in the hunter ring. I've never really seen a horse brace against a standing martingale in the ring. So I think it's just part of the equipment that they use. I mean, I've done hunters for a while and I never used it, but I do see a lot of people with it, and I don't necessarily see the horses being that bad in bringing their heads up. So I think it might just be something that has to do with just equipment habit that they have.
Yeah, and I think that hunter horses in particular are also trained from the start to have a lower headset, so that need to throw the head up isn't necessarily there in the first place, whereas in the jumpers, where you have all sorts of hullabaloo going on, that's where you see more of the head throwing up, because you need the collection, you need the impulsion, and with that comes a higher headset. And it absolutely is, now that you bring it up, as more of a behavioral thing, it absolutely is that, just exactly that. Even with running martingales too, I've had many people say, oh, this horse needs a martingale because it throws their head up. And for me, I have no skin in the game when it comes to training horses. So for me, I can look at it as more of, why is the horse throwing the head up? It's not a big deal to me if we have to take all the tack off and investigate, because I'm not the one taking the horse to a show in 3 months. I don't necessarily have a goal. I'm not riding this horse for a client who's coming back in a month and they want their horse in tip-top shape. And it 100% is a quick fix, because when you take all of the goals and all of the desires away, you don't need any of that. You don't need to put more equipment on your horse to make them perform a certain way, because you have all the time in the world. And I remember a horse who had a chronic rearing problem. She would rear out of seemingly nowhere, and it was really bad. She was in a hollow headset. You could see it in her neck. She had the ewe neck from, you know, having a hollow headset for so long. And I don't know what happened to her, but the person that was riding her just continuously wanted more and more control. She wanted the draw reins, and she wanted the more intense bits, and she wanted the martingales. And for her, this particular horse, the problem was severe enough where she didn't matter. It didn't matter to her what equipment was on her. She was going to rear, because she was not being listened to. And the problem, she got sent away, so I don't know what happened to her, but it was bad enough where for her it could not be suppressed. And to see this person continuously put more and more severe equipment on her was very concerning. And I did my part as much as I could as an employee to speak up about it. And it was one of those things where there was a goal. She had someone leasing the horse. She would be coming back from college soon. And no one wants their client riding a horse that has a chronic rearing problem. So it was something that in her mind needed to be covered up. And there was another horse where thankfully I did get to hear the end of this story, but he had a chronic inverted neck and inverted back. And I had checked the saddle and it was too wide for him. But it was one of those situations where she either rides in the saddle or she doesn't ride at all. So again, I didn't have too much authority over this, but I did tell her, hey, you are riding in a saddle that does not properly fit this horse. So be on the lookout for behaviors that tell you that this horse is uncomfortable. And soon enough, a few weeks later, you get that hollow headset, you get that frame, you get the evading of the bit, and he started refusing as well. And it turns out that he had severe kissing spine. And the person that was in charge of this horse just told the girl to put a breastplate on to fix the saddle and from sliding back, and to put a standing martingale on to prevent his head from going up too high. And it's so unfortunate to see the normalization of quick fixes and band-aids over bullet holes for these horses, because we're seeing the damage. We're seeing the kissing spine, we're seeing the arthritis, we're seeing the pole damage, we're seeing the nerve damage and the scarring in these backs and these muscles. And the fact that it's still not normalized to investigate the behavior is quite unfortunate. And part of the reason why I'm doing this podcast with you as someone who's so experienced with this is that this is a big issue, and it's an issue across all disciplines, and it certainly needs to be addressed. And I used a 3-ring gag bit on a horse who didn't even want to canter, because that's what the professionals used, right? I bought a martingale when the horse didn't need a martingale, because that's what the professionals used. I bought half pads when I was barely even riding this horse on a saddle that already didn't fit, because that's what professionals used. And so not only is it about increasing education across all platforms, but it's also about the role models that these people use. You know, what is John French, who is a popular hunter jumper rider, what is he using on his horses? Is he using certain bits, or is he using certain martingales? There's so much that goes into it that needs investigation, but it is behavioral 100%. I think the use of these fixed martingales, even just in like barrel racing, where I see it commonly in the Western world, is the horse is obviously probably throwing their head up because you have a giant leverage bit on this horse, or you have a twisted wire bit in their mouth. But I don't think that people are thinking about that. They're not thinking about what is causing the behavior. They just want to cover the behavior up. And that really needs to be taught, is that all behavior is a form of communication, and it do not cover it up or you will run into major problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that horseback riding is one of those sports, you know, that's really, really ingrained in tradition. And these methodologies are passed down from, you know, trainer to student for generations. And I think that nobody really stops to ask the important questions. I mean, do we have a better way to do this? Do we have a more harmonious way to train our horses? Do we have better understanding of what it takes to have cooperation and a good relationship with your horse? And I think that there's a lot of questions that are being asked, and I think that there's kind of a wave of reform that's being done in horseback riding, and it's very encouraging. But ultimately, as you said it, when there's an end goal, these types of things are going to keep prevailing. And when you're, and I mean, I used to be the same way. I used to be in a competition barn, and these methods were, and like, granted, they really weren't that bad, but still there are methodologies that I would not use today with the understanding that I have today. And sometimes it takes like with you and your lease horse, you know, that started bleeding of the mouth. And sometimes it takes that kind of situation to stop and ask yourself questions. Is this normal? Like, why are we doing it this way? Is there a better way? And I think that everybody ultimately in their lifetime has that kind of, or hopefully has that aha moment where you kind of have to look at yourself in the mirror and be like, why did this happen? What am I doing? And kind of question these methods, kind of like breaking the cycle of bad methods passed down. And I think we have the tools. And as you said, in all these platforms that are starting to educate more, starting to have a better understanding, I think that we have the tools now to stop kind of living in that sort of ignorant path of outdated training techniques and really start being more welfare centric in what we're doing. And a lot of people, I think, in the competitive world don't have, I guess, the time, because ultimately time is money. And I think people don't have some do. There are so many amazing athletes right now that are really trying to pave the way and trying to show a good example. But yeah, as you said, there's a lot of work to do. And I think that we're kind of going in the right path with people exactly such as Shelby Dennis, that is relentlessly, unapologetically advocating for these animals. And, you know, her bravery is really admirable. And I think that she's kind of paving the way for all of us to kind of advocate and do it fearlessly. And yeah, so yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of tradition to start questioning and bridge that gap, you know, between doing tradition and innovation. And when you're talking about innovation, you're also talking about a more effective way and more efficient way to train these horses, because I think that if you find a way that's going to fix your problem long term, you won't have to spend your money on a million different types of gadgets and mm-hmm. always change your bit or use tranquilizers to get in the trailer and stuff like that. I think that ultimately, like, and it's kind of that concept of, you know, sustainable development where if you find a more efficient way to do it, it's going to pay in the long run. And I think that horses really, you'll be better for it.
Definitely. Yeah. And just going back quickly, the horse that ended up having a bleeding mouth, the reason why I was using the Vienna reins on him was because he had a high headset. But he had a high headset because he was half Arabian. And that's just how he was. And he was also an older horse, so he had a little bit of sway back. And, you know, the saddle that I was using, I'm sure, wasn't fitting on him either. So there was probably discomfort there that was elevating that head as well. And what was really unfortunate is that the trainer that I was training with didn't say anything to me about it. And I wish that there was less fear of speaking up about issues, because if she had told me, hey, like, you're kind of, and this might have been an issue of ignorance as well. She may well just not have known or not have believed that what I was using was causing my horse harm. But there have been instances where I have, or people that I know have, seen something happen and seen a horse being ridden in a clearly damaging way, like in a way that no sane person would be able to defend, and not because clearly these people love their horses, right? They want the best for them. They're using these restrictive aids with them because they want to help support them. And again, when you bring something like that up to someone, most of the time they're going to react defensively because hurting their horse is not their intention. And that's why, in my opinion, education for owners is so important. Not relying on one trainer for all your information is so important, especially here in America, where there is absolutely zero regulation for who can become a trainer. You can take 10 lessons on a horse, and if you have enough money, you can open your barn and start teaching people how to ride horses. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that in and of itself. But when you have people who have such an appeal to tradition and they use methods just because it's what their mom used or it's what their grandparents used or it's what someone 100 years ago used and it worked for them. Open-mindedness and wanting to educate yourself in a way that is for the horse's benefit, not for our benefit, is so important. And delayed gratification as well is so important with horses, because you're not going to see the results on day one if you take a martingale off, or if you take the side reins off, or if you take the draw reins off. You're not going to see an instant change. And it's waiting and waiting and doing things right and taking the time to make mistakes and forgive yourself. But what's beautiful about not restricting horses and doing things in a way that suits them in a biomechanical way is that you can make mistakes because you're allowing the horse to be natural. You're not restricting them in a way where you are preventing communication. So if you do make a mistake when you are riding a horse in a way that suits their needs, they can communicate to you. And that's why educating yourself to prevent bigger issues in the long run is so more important than quick fixes that damage your horse later on. It might not be fun to put in the work of reading books and listening to podcasts and reading articles and making mistakes and then putting in the work, but at least in my experience, where I have caused damage to horses because I thought I knew best and I thought I was doing the best for them, versus now where I can admit that I don't know everything and I want to learn more, and I've taken the time, I've gone to England, I've gotten certified, I've taken the time to do this stuff, and now I can apply it. And the results are 10 times better than I ever could have imagined. Versus whereas when I put those Vienna reins on that horse, he would just protest them. So I ended up getting more behaviors than I wanted in the first place. I saw the result visually. He had a more drawn-in headset, and he looked like a real horse, just like some of these Pessoa systems that we'll talk about shortly do. It gives you the visual, but you get the behavioral 10 times more, at least in horses that have not been shut down. But that is kind of what put me on this whole mission, is that if people took the time to take the resources, you know, read the books, do the courses, be curious, just be curious and open-minded, it will return to you tenfold.
Absolutely. And not wait until something dramatic mm-hmm. has to happen. You know, a lot of people, their education comes at a price, you know, because there's a horse that had to kind of go through it for you to realize. And I think that if from the get-go you try to be a better equestrian and just an informed equestrian, I think you save some horses and yourself a lot of grief.
Definitely. 100%. So lunging, stuff on the lunge. I've seen this one so many times, and it's again one of those things where people want to support their horse. They want to provide them with something that shows them what to do. It kind of puts them in a frame for them, and they're hoping that that will translate into riding. But the Pessoa lunge system, or any really pulley rigged system that basically just kind of works off of pressure and release. And this is from the Pessoa's website, actually, specifically. They said that the Pessoa system is designed to encourage balance and a gradual buildup of top line. The Pessoa system consists of an easy to put together array of ropes, clips, and pulleys, as well as a breeching strap that passes behind the horse's hindquarters and is used in conjunction with a training surcingle while the horse is being lunged. And they do actually claim that this training aid is based on the principles of pressure and release. And then at the end, they say that this advanced training aid should be used by an experienced handler with a horse that has had experience ground driving before using the system. And I asked myself, how many people do you think have ground driven their horses and then used a pulley system? I would say close to none. In my experience in the hunter jumper world, ground driving is not even really a term that anyone's familiar with. It's just not something that is done. And if Pessoa is telling people that this is an advanced training aid and this needs to be used on a horse that is experienced, and I'm seeing it used on young horses to be taught to go into a frame, you kind of have to question, what is it doing to these horses? So in your experience, what is the Pessoa system really?
First, we could probably, just to get back to ground driving. First of all, ground driving is an art in itself. It is a lot harder than people can imagine. If you're doing it properly, you really need to learn how to do it from someone that has experience. And it could be extremely beneficial. And I really love ground driving. I do it a lot with my four-year-old. And it's a really great way to get your horse used to the aids. So when we're talking about these types of lunging aids, it could be the Pessoa or any other. We'll talk about the Pessoa specifically, but in any case, every lunging aid has pretty much the same purpose, right? To put your horse in the frame. So where does it really come from? Basically, when you're trying to train... When you want to train your horse, you're going to lunge your horse, right? And a horse is used to going, or is really good at going in a straight line, that they got it down. But if you're asking a horse to do a 20-meter circle around you, or a 10-meter circle, 15-meter circle around you, the horse needs a little bit of a different type of skill set to do that efficiently. And so you're asking the horse basically to bend, you're asking the horse to balance, you're asking the horse to use his inside leg more. And for us, that's great, because using the inside leg, using the hind inside leg is what we want. We want them to use their hind end, and we want them to bend on the circle. But horses don't do that naturally, and so they get out of balance and they use their head to balance themselves. And so it's not unusual to see a horse on a lunge, especially a young horse on the lunge with the head a little bit higher, kind of getting out of balance. And so these lunging systems are really there the purpose of these lunging aids are to put that horse in the frame. And so what we think we're doing is putting a horse in the frame and helping them use the right muscles, use their top line, use their hind end. But really what we're doing is restricting the horse in a way that it can't balance properly. And in order for the horse to be on that lunge line and using its top line and using its muscles properly and being in a frame, it has to have the muscle to do it. But you're putting this horse, you're kind of doing it backwards when you're using these types of systems, because you're forcing a horse that's not muscular enough to be in that frame to be in frame. And so the analogy that I like to give is, suppose you have absolutely no leg muscle, you're really weak of the legs, and I'm asking you to pick up a really heavy box. Which muscles are you going to use to pick up that heavy box? Your back muscles, right? Because you don't have strong enough legs, and so you're going to use your back to help yourself lift that box. And so it's the same thing that what we're doing to horses is we're asking them to be in a position that they're not strong enough to be in a circle, which is already hard for them, and asking them to use their supposing that they'll probably use the right muscles, but really what they're doing is they're going to accentuate all the asymmetries that they have, and they'll kind of amplify the bad habits that they have and the weaknesses that they have because they don't have the strength to use the right muscles. Mm-hmm. And so they'll be falling back on those muscles that they usually use that are ultimately not the right muscles. And so you're not teaching the horse anything. You're just forcing him to go back into those weaknesses and those bad habits that they have and making them worse, pretty much. And so, I mean, we could talk about the biomechanics of it if you want. I mean, the horse to be in the frame, they need to use all their muscles and the top line, right? Mm-hmm. And all of that is kind of brought together by the nuchal ligament. And so the nuchal ligament attaches from the pole to the withers. And then you have another ligament that goes from the withers to the back end. And basically what we're trying to replicate is to have the horse extend that ligament in order to engage the top line muscles properly. But what you're doing basically is restricting the horse from balancing and using their head properly, which they need for individual gaits. They use their head differently for every gait, for walk, trot, and canter. They'll be using their head to balance those different gaits. And so what we're trying to do is bring the head down to release the nuchal ligament to be able to relax that ligament in the back, and for the horse to be able to tilt its pelvis and use its leg more efficiently to bring under himself. And so that's how we activate the core muscles. And so when you're forcing a horse to put his head down and in with these lunging systems, you're activating the under neck muscles. And so since these muscles are antagonistic to the top muscles, then you're just creating a brace. And so the muscles under the neck are bracing, or they're contracting, and you're having an opposite effect of what you want. So really what we're doing by using these systems is forcing the horse to use the wrong muscles that are used for strength. Exactly. So we're ultimately forcing them to use the wrong muscles because they're not strong enough to use the right muscles, so to say.
Yeah, and so technically you are strengthening your horse, but you're strengthening the wrong part of them. You're strengthening Absolutely. The part that is forced to support the other side of it. For example, I did track in high school. I was a runner in high school, and I struggled with developing my core muscles on my left side because I have a rib deformity on my left side, and I also have a pelvic tilt. So my left side is tilted downwards, and it causes a lot of compensation on my right side as a result. And so I have a lot more developed muscles on my right side. I can feel it in my back, and I also am quite sore on that side frequently. And I'm telling you, if my coach placed me in some sort of brace or some sort of thing that was supposed to either tilt me back the right way or, you know, force my muscles to work properly, I wouldn't be able to do it. Just like I tried running I tried putting like a lift in my left shoe to get my pelvis more even. And it did even out my pelvis, but it caused even more compensation on my right side because I was asked to work the muscles on my left side, and my body was so not used to that, that my right side had to work more as a result. So it almost had the opposite effect that I was looking for. And what would have helped me in that instance was just knowledgeably training that left side. And how can you teach a horse to do that if you can't verbally explain to them, hey, you've got an imbalance here, like walk out in the pasture this way, or when I'm riding you, I need you to exert yourself this way. We can't. And that's why prior perception is important, which I will ask you about later. But these systems, the PSOA system that is supposed to put a horse into a frame and make them work a certain way, all it does is work the muscles that they already have, essentially, is what I'm getting. Because if you ask them to work weak muscles and they don't have the support that they need for that, I'm assuming that their body is just going to compensate and strengthen the ones that they already have and the ones that are asked to support.
100%. And when we're talking about these types of lunging aids, it really comes down to the fact that the only horses that are able to sustain a proper position in these systems are the ones that ultimately don't need to be in those systems. And so if a horse is able or strong enough to be in self-carriage position, then there's absolutely no use for those systems. But if you have a horse that has difficulty staying in that frame, then you don't want to force it to be in that frame for a long time. You want to start exercising those muscles gradually, mm-hmm. for them to be in the end able to hold self-carriage, and then you would just not need to use those systems whatsoever.
Right, exactly.
So again, we're talking about a quick fix, right?
Yep. Oh, for sure. That's all it really is, are quick fixes. Because again, if you don't have goals, or you understand that if your horse isn't developed by 6, they're not going to fall apart. If you don't have a goal and you are okay with waiting, you don't need any of that stuff. You don't need a lunging aid. You can work with your horse with what they have, use their body as their body, because that's what horses know best. And they don't want to be restricted as prey animals. They need their freedom. And so if anything, even just talking about the mental side of it, what are we doing to our horses when we force them to operate in a way that offsets their balance? For example, I'm working with a little Arabian mare, and I've been bringing her in and out of the outdoor arena just to get her used to it. And I've been attempting to pick her feet in the outdoor arena, and it has a giant overlook where you can see all sorts of trees, and there's so much open space, and it's just not an area that she's comfortable in. And for a very long time, I could not pick her feet in that arena because their balance is everything to them. And having one foot off of the ground, and especially being held onto by a predator, that's not very encouraging to survival. And I'm sure that it made her feel very unstable and uncomfortable. And so that's just holding her foot. What if now we have a rope attaching to the bit and around their bum and under their belly? We have all sorts of restrictive stuff around them, and they cannot move out of it until we take it off of them. And if they try and protest it, they just get more discomfort and pain from trying to go outside of it. And so even just asking the emotional side of it too, from a perspective of an animal that where restriction means death and being eaten by a predator. That's something that I think we as equestrians need to consider as well on a variety of topics, is what is this doing to our horses' mental state, besides their physical state as well?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think that they kind of go hand in hand, right? Where if a horse isn't able to relax into the exercise, then there'll be as well physical implications. And so it's really important to look at training in a holistic view, and mm-hmm. to be able to determine what conditions am I putting my horse in for training. Is the physical conditions adequate? Are the mental conditions adequate? And to be able to assess the environment in which you're putting your horse in.
Yeah, 100%. So another lunging aid that I wanted to talk about that is also very popular are side reins, and mm-hmm. bungee side reins, or the side reins with the little donut in them. When I was in England and I was training with the British Horse Society, side reins were required as part of the lunging test. And how they fit them was you would attach the side rein to the girth, and then you would extend it to the neck while the neck was in a neutral position, and you wanted a fist between the side rein and the bit. So effectively, you were restricting them because you're taking their neutral headset, the headset that they want to be in front of the vertical, and you're bringing that in by about 2 or 3 inches, maybe 4, depending on the size of your hand. But I think to a lot of people, it's not seen that way because it's just a simple piece of equipment. It's just a rope or a piece of bungee that you attach to the side. And I'm forgetting what their exact intended purpose is. I'm not sure if it's, is it just to maintain their head and neck posture? Is that what they're for, basically?
Yeah, I think they're mostly intended for to help the horse release in the neck, so mm-hmm. have kind of a lower or extend the neck. But I mean, again, like any other of these lunging aids, it can really have the opposite effect and a detrimental effect to the physical well-being of the horse, just because. So as I explained before, when you want a neutral head position, so when you want the head to be a little bit lower, more extended, then, I mean, that's where you're engaging the top line. And so you want the nuchal ligament to be relaxed. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, if your horse is able to relax into that posture, then you have no activity in the under neck. You only have the top neck that's kind of holding the head up. So it's kind of going against gravity. So you have the head that's kind of lowering, but you have those top neck muscles that are keeping it in place and helping the horse balance. And so as soon as you have something that's restrictive, and the horse can't balance, such as with side reins, the horse is going to brace against the bit. So in that kind of stride cycle, where the head is supposed to be maybe a little bit more forward for the horse to balance in a certain pace, well, then the horse has no choice but to be heavy in the bit. And so either you're teaching your horse to be heavy in the bit, which is kind of counterproductive, mm-hmm. Or you're teaching the horse to evade the bit and then go behind the vertical. And so one of those two things could happen potentially. And when you have a horse that's bracing against it, then you have the underside of the neck, so the bottom muscles that are kind of controlling the angle, the head and neck angle. And so kind of like with roll cur, where the head and neck angle is really steep, and so you have a horse that's really close to it, the head that's really close to the neck, and so there you really have that underside muscle that is working, and the top muscle is working to extend, so you're widening the angle between the head and neck, and that's ultimately what you want. You want a long neck, you want an open throat, and that's what engages the hind end. And so when you have side reins and you have a horse that's bracing against the bit or evading the bit, then you have that situation where the head and neck angle is really small and you have a horse that's using its under neck to balance and to maintain the position to evade the bit. And so again, you have the opposite effect with a horse that's not able to balance. I mean, that's what you get. You get the complete wrong support system in the neck that's working.
Yeah, it almost seems like you get the opposite of what you want, really. You get by wanting your horse to be relaxed and work into the aids and work over their back and use their hind end, you get almost the opposite. You get bracing, you get restriction, you get evasion, and it really is kind of just counterproductive 100%. It's kind of
absolutely
funny to be
and honest. There's so many studies, there's a bunch of studies that show this, and you know, like I went through a bunch of them that were testing the PSOA, that were testing the side raids, that were testing the goat and the chambon, and the chambon, and they used they use thermography to mm-hmm. see which muscles are being activated just by heat dissipation. And it's really interesting because most of these studies kind of are in favor or just kind of express that there is more muscular activation mm-hmm. with these training aids. But the fact is that you really see a concentration of the heat through the thermography, because you could really see basically the front end light up, really, really light up. And so you have really concentrated red spots where you could see that the pecs are working. You could see the abs working. You could see the shoulders working, and you could see the base of the neck working. And you for sure, you want some of those muscles to be working. And if you see a heightened activity in those muscles, you can't necessarily say that that's because the lunging aid is working. What you want is kind of more of a uniform activation of the muscles. And so you can't kind of conclude that your training aid is working because the muscles are more activated when you just have the wrong muscles that are being activated. And you want to see the entire neck. You want to see the upper neck. You want to see the more of the back. You don't want to just see the spine light up, you know? And so you really have to be careful when interpreting these results and seeing the effect that it has on the horse, where you could ultimately see that the most important muscles are not working. There are more muscles that are working, but the important ones aren't working. So ultimately, you're just causing strain on your horse. You're causing a lot of use of the front end muscles. And that could be very damaging for horses, especially horses that have pathologies, you know, in the front, and that have strain in their tendons and in their feet. It's just, you're just creating a whole chain of problems.
Yeah, and it seems like the goal of most of these is to get a horse into some sort of frame, which is usually seen as the lifting of the back, the engagement of the hindquarters, and the lowering or neutral position of the neck. Where, from a biomechanical standpoint, from like an interior anatomy standpoint, where do you think this desire for horses to be in that set frame where they have the core engaged, they have the hind end, where does that come from? Why do we want horses to look like that?
So I think that ultimately a horse that is using his frame or is working in a proper frame is using his body correctly. I think we just kind of prioritize what it's supposed to look like instead of what it's supposed to feel like. Mm-hmm. And basically, I mean, if the head is, because the head is the end goal, right? And so I think that there's so much to work on a horse before you get the lowering of the head or you get that head in the proper frame. And I think that people kind of associate the position of the head with success in using the top line, which really isn't, because if you're compressing the neck and the head in a way that is not using the whole body properly, then you have a hollow back and you're using the wrong muscles and you're creating problems in the spine and you're shortening the stride. So you're not getting a more fluent stride in your horse. And so I think that it's really important to know the difference between kind of a false frame, I guess you could say, versus what the actual frame is supposed to look like. And I think that you need a trained eye. I mean, not everybody could identify when a horse is actually lifting the back properly or engaging the hind end properly. But I think that's where we need to start. We have to stop focusing. And I tell this to my clients a lot. You know, like, oh no, my horse is doing fine. They work with their head low. And I say, yeah, but you know, like you have to forget the head. You have to stop looking at the head and look at the rest, because the head is a result of that. And so I think we're kind of creating a false sense of accomplishment when we see that horse with a head that's in the frame, because we're doing it with lunging aids. We're not doing it by teaching the horse how to use his muscles efficiently.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely do judge a horse's frame success on the position of the head or whether the horse is even in a frame or round. In my experience in the hunter jumper world, particularly the hunters, so many people would just say, oh, that horse is collected. Look, the head is down. That dressage horse is collected. The head is high up and, you know, it's high up and the neck is curled, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is that, like you said, it's the result. The head looks like that because there are so many other body parts working in conjunction to create, I'm assuming, the nuchal ligament relax and out like that. And when you kind of just separate into pieces and you simplify it as, oh, train your eye to look at the neck, a lowered neck or a neck that's curled in some sort of manner, that's a horse in a frame, that's a horse that's round. And in my experience, I think that's what drives a lot of hunter riders to use this sort of restrictive equipment, is because the head is the easiest way to tell what the body is doing, essentially. And so many people see a head that is lowered and they assume that that means that the horse is in a frame. And a head with a neutral headset is one where the body is working as it should be. And in my experience, seeing horses on the lunge line before a show, cantering for 30 minutes with a Pessoa rig on, that's not what's really happening there. And so just quickly, if the neck is the result and that's not where people should be focusing, on someone who doesn't have a professional experienced eye like you, what would you say that we should be looking for, except besides the neck?
Top line is a really pretty explicit way to, it's as soon as you see identifying an underdeveloped top line is pretty simple, just because you could really see where there's atrophy. Mm-hmm. So right behind the withers, you could really see that there's a dip. The hind end as well. I mean, you could really see underdeveloped muscles in the hind end. That's not really hard to see. You could really see as well in the neck how it's being developed. And so if you have the upper neck or near the pole that's a little bit more strained because of these lunging aids or because the horse is really working only with its neck and not with the rest of its body, you'll see places in the neck that's overdeveloped. And you could see gaps as well between the shoulder and the neck. So what you really want to see is a nice, uniform, filled out neck. And that's where you'll know that your horse is working with its neck properly. But as well, you know, behind the withers is also a pretty good way to tell if your horse is using its back properly or not. It can come from atrophy in that area. It can also come from bad saddle fit. But ultimately, if you have bad saddle fit, your horse isn't using his back properly anyways, right? So those are all kind of hints that your horse is not using his top line properly.
Definitely. And in my journey of understanding saddle fit, something that I just cannot unsee is that dip behind the withers where the trapezius muscle lies. And it is so common, unfortunately, in horses who, there's kind of a connection. You see the high headset, you see the underdeveloped neck, you see the underdeveloped top line, and then you see that dip behind the withers, that something's not fitting right. The horse is trying to avoid some sort of discomfort that happens when they do engage the core and that muscle does fill out, the saddle doesn't fit properly, something's going on. But I will say that that is something that is definitely a chronic issue in at least the hunter jumper circuit. There are so many people that are claiming to fit saddles, but they're more doing it in a way that either makes the saddle fit, for example, using a bunch of shims and pads, or fitting the saddle to the rider and basically just saying, oh, yep, there's wither clearance, there's clearance through the spine, we're all good to go. And really, what I've learned is that there's a lot more to it. And the result of working at a competition barn for 3 years and seeing various saddle fitters come out and try and fit these saddles to these horses is that it's never worked out. And the horse just continuously becomes more uncomfortable. And what happens is people don't understand the root cause of the issue. And that's when they go to add more equipment to seemingly fix the problem. And they don't really know what to look for, unfortunately, and people don't know how to find the root of the problem. But another thing that I've been kind of more researching is proprioception. Am I saying that right? Proprioception. There we go. That's right. Yeah. Proprioception, which is my understanding out of it is just awareness of the body. And I would like to hear more about that from you, because it's just from the little that I've learned about it, even from some of the reels that you've made, is that it's really quite beneficial in actually teaching a horse to support themselves and be more aware of their body. So I would love to hear about more about that and how we can benefit our horse's health by teaching them how to do that.
Yeah, sure. So you could work proprioceptions in so many different ways and do really fun games with your horse. You really have to be willing to do groundwork, mm-hmm. obviously. So proprioception basically is, as you said, it's awareness of how they use their body. In a stride or on terrain or, you know, like in different stances, you know, really it's kind of a holistic way of seeing how a horse controls, all his limbs. And so basically how you could work with proprioception is, pole work is a very popular one. And so there's a million different exercises that you could do with that. And as you're developing or kind of showing a horse how to be aware of where they're stepping, you build a lot of confidence because, you know, we know that horses are prey animals and their legs to them are everything. And so for them to build confidence in that area is really important. But you also get balance comes, it basically is what is going to help them find that frame in on the lunge and in that circle. And so it's very important for them to develop these skills as you're working towards finding the frame in ridden work, but also in ground work. And so for me, I wouldn't start with proprioception per se, but I think that it's a very important complementary strategy to have in your training protocol. And also it helps kind of diversify the activities that you're doing with your horse. So it could be good also for mental stimulation, for concentration. And so I think that it's important to integrate. So yeah, with pole work, but you could also go on like different types of terrain, just basically go through, you know, if you have sand, if you have a little like a woody forest, if you have even the street, gravel, hills, all of those things could really help proprioception and ultimately help balance in the horse.
Awesome. That sounds wonderful. Thank you very much. So high level question, can training gadgets like we've mentioned before, the draw reins, the fixed martingales, the side reins, can they ever be used in a way that does foster good balance and muscle use and muscle development? Can they be used for the horse's long-term benefit and health? And if not, where would someone start who is having these sorts of issues that would warrant covering it up with training aids? Where could someone start to holistically help their horse find themselves?
I mean, well, for your first question, can they be used in a productive manner? I don't really think so, but this is a personal opinion. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that are going to have different opinions on training aids. There might be some instances during rehab that you're using them temporarily, very loosely, conservatively, for some type of thing that you want to do. But in general, I don't think that if you're taking the time and going through the steps and you have the time to do it, I don't think ultimately that you would ever need to use training aids. And so that brings me to your second question. Where do you start teaching a horse how to work properly without the use of training aids? I think that it really comes from balance. And so that's something that you have to let your horse kind of figure out on its own. And so by restricting the head, you're kind of not letting him figure out where his body is supposed to be positioned in a circle. And so you want to start, and I say in the circle because ultimately when you're training a young horse, you're starting with lunging exercises usually. And so I think that it's important to help that horse find its own pace and to go through the steps gradually and just kind of encourage the horse to start relaxing on the lunge. And so I think that's the first step, is just, and also like I advocate for this a lot, it's just walking could really go a long way, because when we're talking about just literally walking, we're really forcing the horse to use all the back muscles. And so when you're on a circle, you have lateral activation of those muscles. And so let's say I'm going on a circle on the right hand, and then you're kind of forcing those, to ensure balance, you're forcing the right side of those back muscles to start working. So if you're going on a 5 meter circle, then 10 meter circle, 20 meter circle, and then you're kind of forcing that horse to use those muscles, and that's where it starts, right? And so I think just by using exercises that, yeah, they seem boring and it takes some time, but I think that that's really where you start, is at just the most basic exercises. And so gradually, by starting there, you're forcing the horse, or you're teaching the horse that those are the muscles that need to be used, but also you're kind of getting him in the habit of using those muscles, getting him used to using those muscles, and getting those muscles ready for the next step, you know, a step up. And so you could start by just walking your horse in a circle, and then trotting your horse in the circle, and then going over poles, and just relentlessly working on balance. Balance is really what it comes down to. And as your horse is discovering how to place his body through proprioception and through balance, then you'll start seeing the difference in the muscle development. And as that muscle development increases, then you'll have a horse that's really able to hold the frame, and then you have self-carriage. And so I think groundwork is absolutely 100% the most important place to start.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I 100% agree. I believe that walking is very underrated, the walk gait. I think that a lot of riders, at least under saddle, aren't very interested in it because it's slow. You know, people want to get going. They want to canter. They want to jump. They want to do their activity. And walking is kind of just the courtesy gait of like, yeah, I need to get your limbs and your joints working. I'll let you walk for a few minutes and then we'll get going. It's kind of just, and then I'll cool you out at the end too, because I don't want you to tie up or get colic. I think that walking is very underrated as just developing muscles, teaching the horse to work with what they have and learn where they are. You know, this the turtle wins the race, the slow one wins the race, right? We get horses who are just used to going fast and being kind of high strung and out of the place. And then you have the horses who go slow. And I think that walking that gait, you can really take your time. And, you know, a misstep in the walk is a misstep in the walk. It's not in the trot where they're going to possibly trip and fall over. And so I do think that it's a very underrated gait. So thank you for that. I'm sure that was very helpful for a lot of people. And I would like to add on top of that as well that I think that a lot of reasons why people may use training gadgets or training aids for a young horse or an older horse that is coming back to work is, again, like you said, behavioral problems, problems that have more of a root physical cause, such as throwing the head because there's discomfort over the back, or having a hollow headset as a youngster because they don't know how to use their body properly. Or rearing up because there's a back problem there, or there's a hoof problem there. Hooves aren't developed enough to support the horse, even if they were balanced, stuff like that. And I would like to say to people that if you are having a problem with your horse that you want to cover up because it's a dangerous behavior, or it's not a pretty behavior, or you just don't want to deal with it, I would take everything off and let the horse express themselves. Let them tell you what exactly is bothering them, where exactly is bothering them, where when you ask them to collect or extend or move faster, where they say, nope, this does not feel good, I'm not doing this. You know, be curious, investigate, go beyond just wanting things exactly your way and wanting things to be fluid. Training is not linear. It's up and down. It goes around in circles. It happens. These are horses. They cannot speak to us, and they know that we are predators, which opens up a bunch of behavioral things that we would either label as disrespectful or in need of correction. So if your horse is displaying behaviors that you would label in need of covering up or restricting, do the opposite. Don't restrict them. Let them be free and understand that the behavior is an attempt at communication. And if you handle them properly and let the horse express themselves and tell you what's wrong, you will never run into, it's very unlikely that you will ever again run into an explosive horse that you are handling with, because so it takes away the need to restrict them and the need to put them into this ball because you listen to him. And so the reasons that would warrant that behavior are not even there in the first place. And that is something that I wish I knew a long time ago. And I think I would have not caused a lot of discomfort to the horses that I caused discomfort to.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important what you said was to let the horse express himself. And that was a huge turning point for me in my journey with my horse, because of the fact that she, during her backing process, she was being very explosive. And the only way that I could get her to express herself without kind of being shut in and then explode was to teach her how to express herself. And so I really started doing Liberty just for that purpose, because when she was in a bigger area and she was able to escape that area, then she felt less trapped and she would just walk away. When she was uncomfortable with a certain situation, she would have the right to just walk away. And so there I could gradually kind of figure out what it is that stressed her out or made her explosive, and just kind of work gradually through those steps to make it less stressful for her. And I think that when you have a horse that's shut down and that has a tendency to explode, then you have to take that extra step to show them that they can express themselves safely and that they will be listened to. And then you have just a better foundation for training after that.
I agree. And I would also add on top of that for people not to give up if they do try to let their horse express themselves and all of a sudden you have all of these behaviors that didn't happen before come out of the blue. It may seem that this is just making the problem worse, but actually what's happening is that you're giving your horse autonomy, right? So when I began training this little Arabian mare and I started doing more work with her at liberty when she was just free to walk away, she was free to go and eat grass when she wanted to, she did. She walked away. There were some days where even in her paddock with her friends, she didn't want me picking her feet. And it wasn't an inconvenience to me because I didn't have a lesson to go to in 20 minutes. I didn't have a show that I needed to prepare her for, but it was quite interesting because as soon as you tied her up or restricted her, she would give you her feet because she had no choice. Versus when she did have a choice, she would just walk away. And it ended up being one of those things where she had not had her feet done in a long time. And she was on a 6-week trim cycle. And so she had quite a lot of dead hoof and her hooves were long and it was likely causing her discomfort. And those are the sort of things that I would never have known or I never would have had an explanation for had I just continued to cover up behaviors and not become curious about what she was showing me. And I'm sure, especially with your mare, when you backed her and there were all sorts of these explosive problems, you could have just said, nope, we're not doing this. I'm putting all sorts of stuff on you and you're going to do it. But in the long run, that never works out because when you understand that all behavior is communication, you want the behavior. You want them to tell you when something is hurting them because you know that if you suppress it, it's going to come back tenfold later on. And that's not something that we want with our horses, especially young ones that are learning to trust humans and learning the meaning behind why we're doing all this sorts of stuff with them. So if you find yourself taking stuff away and you see 10 times more behaviors than when you restricted your horse, it's a good thing because, well, it might not be a good thing because the cause of it might be pain and discomfort, but you're letting your horse communicate.
It's a good first step.
Yes, it's a good first step, and it's communication. And when you allow communication, it opens the doors for all sorts of wonderful stuff to happen in training.
Absolutely. And you're building longevity in your relationship and, I mean, in your horse's life for sure.
Definitely. So are there any sort of products or even just, for example, a bell boot on a hoof that's a little more dragging behind? Is there anything that you would suggest equipment-wise for people to use when their horse does need a little more support or they are a little bit weak coming back from rehab, etc.?
No, not particularly. Honestly, I think that it comes down to kind of a strengthening protocol that doesn't necessarily require equipment. I mean, in the sense that you could use poles, you could use long reining, you could definitely lunge your horse, no problem. But just, I think everything needs to be done in moderation and needs to be done at the pace of the horse. You have to keep an eye on the development of your horse, just to make sure that it's going in the right direction. So you have to really stay vigilant with that. And yeah, ultimately listen to your horse, and just know the signs, you know. But in terms of equipment, if you have the time and you have the patience for it, I don't think that any of it would actually be required at all. I think that you could do everything just with the natural stance of your horse, and with diversified terrain.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we are lacking as well, is diversified terrain, for sure. I mean, yeah. You have a grass paddock, a dirt paddock, and then you have a sand arena or some other thing. We don't really see gravel or rock or hills where horses can kind of offset their balance and figure out how to rebalance themselves. It's more flat terrain, maybe a little bit of hills, and the human supporting the horse. It's not the horse supporting the horse. And that's what I think we need a lot more of. But just to sum up everything that we've talked about so far, we mentioned some training aids on the under saddle, on the lunge. We talked about draw reins, side reins, Pessoa systems. We spoke about side reins. I think I already said that. And the one thing that we didn't talk about was a degogue and a chambon, which, in my opinion, when I saw them, I was quite horrified by what they did to the horse. But all in all, both of those, in my opinion, are just a little more severe examples of restriction and aids. But all in all, it seems that these training aids, one, aim to give you a result faster, or two, aim to support the horse in a way and help them balance themselves, but it almost seems to do the opposite, because like you said, holistic care, helping the horse support themselves by themselves, is really the best thing that you can do, because sometimes in these systems all they're working off of is pressure and release, and they're not understanding the meaning behind what it is exactly you want them to do, what muscle group you want them to use, and it's very well possible that they might not be able to use that muscle group because it's not developed.
Absolutely. And ultimately, it comes down to the same thing for every type of system, and I think that we could talk about them in general, because at the end of the day, they kind of all have the same impact, mm-hmm. you know, so they all have the pressure basically in the same areas, and so the result will be pretty much the same.
Yeah, and usually it's not a good result. I have yet to see a horse who has perfect balance and perfect muscle development from using all this sorts of stuff. In fact, it's usually sometimes the opposite, and you get more problem behaviors because, again, you are suppressing and restricting. But I think that just about quite covers it for me. I think we had quite a good conversation here. It's been...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this was just great. I've used stuff like this before. I've never used draw reins. I used the Vienna reins and, you know, martingales, but for me, they never worked out. And so I think my lease horse's mouth bleeding was kind of, like you said, the turning point of this is not normal, and it wasn't necessarily giving me a result in the first place, and it was traumatizing enough where I never wanted to use anything like that again. And throughout my journey of not having a horse, not leasing a horse, not necessarily riding, having no skin in the game, I just learned about the true effect of this stuff. And I think that's where a lot of riders fall short, is that they are involved with these horses. They do have shows to go to. They do have goals. And so the idea of letting go like this is quite scary to some people, because a lot of it, I think, is fear of the unknown or just not knowing. They don't know how to support their horse without equipment. So equipment is the best thing that they have. But something I'm big on is that we're obligated to train these horses in a way that suits their needs, because we'll never fully understand what's going through their head, what their emotional state is, what exactly their health looks like. And so the best thing that we can do for them is support them naturally. And I think that's something that, judging by what you've said and your page, that you agree with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of the day, I think it all comes down to education and just kind of knowing the impact that you have on your horse, depending on what type of strategy that you're using. And just to find one that is more harmonious to your horse's body and development. And so, yeah, just education, finding someone that could support you the right way, that's in line with your values. and just being aware of the impact that you have on your horse and how the horse changes behaviorally and physically along the way.
For sure. And curiosity as well. It's very important. Wanting to learn more. Yeah. Wanting to educate yourself.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, Alisa, for coming on. This has been wonderful. I hope that we have taught at least a few people something new about these sorts of training aids. And I've learned something myself as well. This has been a wonderful conversation, and education is very important to both of us. And I think that is exactly what we are doing here. So thank you very much for having this conversation with me today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this podcast. Stay tuned for more. I hope to have more conversations like this, helping you guys understand how we can improve our horses' health together. Talking about this stuff is very important. Having discussions about this, being open-minded, and wanting to continuously educate ourselves. And if you are currently listening to this right now, I believe that you are one of those people. So keep doing what you're doing, and we hope to talk to you soon.